Word of mouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with Stephen Breyer, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Breyer was appointed Associate Justice of the Supreme Court by President Clinton in 1994. He is now 78 and author of several books throughout his distinguished career, some academic, others displaying his unbridled enthusiasm for the democratic system and his belief that it is the court's job to make the government work for real people living today. His most recent book, The Court and the World, makes the case that in an age of global interdependence, America's government, business, citizenry, and conflict transcend national boundaries. International issues are now more common on court dockets, requiring federal judges to better understand foreign reasoning and laws. Judicial awareness can no longer stop at the borders, he writes, a statement akin to poking at a hornet's nest of his conservative critics and fellow justices. Justice Stephen Breyer buoyantly stepped out onto the stage of the Music Hall's historic theater to argue against American judicial isolationism.
If I have a broader objective in mind, I think it's sort of this. I don't know about you, but sometimes we hear words like globalization. Or interdependence. And when I hear words like that, we're talking about literature, I think of a great book, The Charterhouse of Palmer, fabulous book. Stendhal opens this book with his hero, Fabrice Del Dongo, is at Waterloo. And the bullets are back and forth, whizzing past. The fog of war is everywhere. Napoleon is going back and forth on his horse. And the hero thinks to himself, Fabrice says, he says, something really important is happening here. He says, I wish I knew what it was. And that's sort of the way I feel sometimes when I hear people talking about the changes in the world and interdependence and so forth. So I thought it might help to look, in a sense, through a microscope at one institution and how those big words and what is going on are in detail and specifically with examples changing what we do. And they are. And I'd like people to know that, and I'd like them to see the kinds of problems that we face in this area. And they're problems, a major problem. This document, the Constitution, gives to the President of the United States and the Congress of the United States the power to decide matters of security. They're supposed to keep us safe. Judges don't know much about that. But we do have a role in protecting basic liberties. So what happens when those two clash? What happens when the president or Congress infringes basic liberties? For a long time, the judges had the answer to exactly what they should do. Namely, nothing. The person who brought that up first, or I don't know if it was first, close to first, Cicero. Cicero invented this phrase, which my Latin teacher would probably turn over in his grave if I tried to pronounce it in Latin. But it was something like arma dicant leges silent or something, which for years I would translate if I was giving a talk about it. I'd say, when the cannons roar, the laws fall silent. And I did that quite a lot until somebody pointed out that the Romans didn't have cannons. All right, so that sort of wrecked that. But nonetheless, you get the idea. And that's what we followed for a long time. I mean, think of the Alien and Sedition Acts back in the founding of the Republic. John Adams, who was a hero, of course, but he did put quite a few people in jail for what they said. Courts didn't do much. Abraham Lincoln, Civil War, thousands of people put in prison. What did the courts do? They did something after the war was over. You see the attitude? But where did that attitude lead us? It led us to a lot of suppression of free speech in World War I, and in World War II, it led us to, 70,000 American citizens of Japanese origin, taken from their homes in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and put in camps. On what basis? None. None, really. And now let's go to Guantanamo. And suddenly we have four cases, all of whom are brought by the detainee and the detainee wins every one of them. The detainee, bin Laden's chauffeur, not the most popular person in the United States, but he won his case against the president or the secretary of defense, the most powerful people in quite a wide area. And what's going on there? We said Congress had gone too far with this law. It's unconstitutional when you try to keep them out of court and so forth and so on. I'll spare you the details. But what's really happening there is what Sandra O'Connor said, and I joined, and she said, the Constitution does not write the president a blank check, not even in wartime. But the problem is the question that will now occur to you. It's already in your mind. If the Constitution does not write the president a blank check, even in wartime, what kind of check does it write? Now do you see the problem? That's a long windup for a short pitch. And the pitch is simply that we are in a world where there are security problems. And they're not just national, they're all over the world. There are problems of terrorism. And there are laws quite likely that will be challenged in our court. And if we're saying no blank check, we have to decide when yes, when no. And that's not so easy to do, of course. And what I'm arguing here in the book is in order to do that sensibly, we have to know something about this problem of terrorism, and we have to know something about security, and we have to know something about what's going on abroad, and we have to know something about what other countries do. We're not the only democracy in the world. There's a lot we have to know. And that's what I'm trying to illustrate. Now, I can illustrate the same thing in the area of commerce. I can give you case after case. Where? I mean, you know, a little dull, but nonetheless, a vitamin distributor in Uruguay, you know, sues a vitamin company in Holland. He says the company, the manufacturer, raised prices. In a cartel, where's he suing him? New York City. Why is he suing him in New York City? There are a couple of answers. One possibly is, see, the price of vitamins was so high that he couldn't afford them, and he got so weak he couldn't get all the way. That's a possibility. Another possibility is what's called treble damages under our law. Can he do it or not do it? We have briefs filed from countries all over the world, Japan, France, England, and lawyers in different places giving them their view, and we can't decide the case sensibly without knowing something of those other countries' laws. There are examples all over the place. And that's what I'm doing here. And treaties today are somewhat, there are a lot that are quite different from treaties 100 years ago or 50 years ago even. So we used to be, Japan and the United States agree that, Thailand and the United States agree that. No, there are quite a lot today that instead of doing that, they get a group of nations, and the group of nations by treaty or by some other agreement establishes a little bureaucracy. And that little bureaucracy creates rules. And those rules bind people in practice from more than one nation. And we belong, the United States, to several hundred. Probably close to 1,000. I mean, you've heard of a lot, the International Trade Organization, the UN, and so forth. I mean, and maybe you've heard of the Bluefin Whale Commission, I don't know. I hadn't until I read about it, but it's there. And what about the International Olive Oil Council? I don't know how many have heard of that. But they are all over the place. But the point is, what's the legal status of these rules? This is a question that's been answered, or tried to answer, in Europe, where the German court and the Italian court and the Austrian court all have to decide to what extent their constitutions allow their country to delegate a lot of legislative power to the European Union. And they all say, you can do it, but not too much. That's basically what they say. Now, they've never found one that was too much. Will we have that kind of problem? Maybe. By the way, if we do, and if the result is, we haven't had it yet, but if we do, if the result is that no, Congress can't delegate any of this authority, well then how are we supposed to go about deciding? How? To cooperate with other nations, to solve problems, or try to solve them, or at least make a dent in problems like environment, health, safety, trade, security, all those things that are today more than one. Involve many nations. How are we to do that? But if the sky's the limit, what happens here with this document? where Article 1 says the legislative power is delegated here, it's vested in a Congress of the United States, not the Bluefin Whale Commission. You see the problem? All right, what I'm trying to do is illustrate, and I could spend a long time, but I won't. So why did I write this? Well, of course, one reason I wrote it is my typical reason for writing something. You know, when you write something, you'll see, I think many of you, as you get older, you say, I want to write this down. My problem's writing it, somebody else is just reading it. But that's what you feel like. But I want continuously, and we all feel that way, all nine of us, we want to explain to people how the court works. We think absolutely that next generation has to know. And the generation after that, now my grandchildren, they've got to know. Because if they don't know, they won't participate in politics or in government, and that will be just terrible. This document won't work if they don't participate. And so they have to know. That's one reason. A second reason is because there is a thought going around in some circles. I'm not criticizing it or not, and it doesn't have much to do with law. It's more politics, so I shouldn't talk about it at all, but let's pretend it's law. And what they say, what they say is, they say, we don't want you to look abroad. We don't want you to look abroad for anything. This is an American constitution. Get it? And we have certain American values. I was talking to a congressman about this. We were in a kind of public debate, and he said that, and I said, I guess you're aiming that at me. And he said, yeah, I was actually. So I said, well, let me tell you why I do it. I do that sometimes, refer to what happens abroad, because other people in this world have jobs like mine, judges. They have documents like this one, protecting human rights and democracy, and they have problems like mine. So why don't I read what they say, if they have a similar problem and a similar document? It won't hurt. I don't have to follow it. He says, fine, read it. Just don't put it in your opinion. I said, not knowing when I ought to keep quiet. I then say, well, but there's more than that. There is also the fact that there are a lot of new countries. Democracy is a new thing in some places. They're setting up independent judiciaries to try to safeguard it to some degree. They're doing their best. And they're met with opposition in their legislature. They refer to our cases. If we refer to theirs, they'll have, you know, a little more prestige, perhaps, because we're an old court, and maybe that'll help them. He says, fine, write them a letter. Just don't put it in your opinion. So that's who I'm writing for, in part. I want to say to that congressman and others, look, let me tell you what we really do. And when I tell you what we really do, and I show you in detail, maybe you will then begin to agree with me that the best way to preserve our American values, the best way to preserve that which is embodied in this document, is to cooperate and know something about what happens abroad. Because after all, if we ignore the rest of the world will go on without us, and they might find solutions or try that will affect us, and they will just affect us in a lot worse ways than if we were involved too. That's a message I'm trying to get across. And of course, I'm also trying to explain what it means to try to solve these problems through a rule of law. Because after all, I know it's self-serving, that's my profession. But I tell the students at Stanford, I did last, where, you know, if you don't follow the rule of law, if you don't try to support that, if you don't explain to people what it's about, you can only have the alternative. And the alternative is pretty bad. Go look at the television set. Go turn it on and see. So we're for that. And on a general level, I'm trying to show what it might mean, at least in part, and I'm trying to show what we do, and I'm trying to show why what we do so much today. It's not a question of judicial philosophy, not a question of individual judges, it is a question of the state of the world, which is in fact forcing upon us the kinds of problems that we're trying to deal with.
Word of mouth!
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Stephen Breyer, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. An unapologetic pragmatist, Stephen Breyer champions what he calls the living constitution, the idea that the values outlined by the framers must be molded to our contemporary society. That and his internationalist scope have put him at odds with constitutional originalists or textualists, like the staunchly conservative late Justice Antonin Scalia, who believe judges should hew strictly to the original meaning of the text as written. Breyer and Scalia gamely debated in public forums for more than a decade. I sat down with Justice Breyer on stage at the Music Hall to talk about his book, The Court and the World, and to ask questions submitted by the audience. I began by asking about his life. He's married to a British-born psychologist and is one of a dozen foreign members of an elite French academy. He's lived in Paris and has taught in Rome and in Australia and actively confers with judges in India, China, and all over the world. I asked Justice Breyer how his cosmopolitan life and connections have influenced his global view of the law.
I grew up in San Francisco. All right, when I grew up, I don't want to date myself. But a real foreign trip was going with my father on the Lark, which was a train that ran to Los Angeles. I did get a scholarship and studied in England. That's true. That was amazing. But today, take the college students or even the high school students. They've been all over the place.
They've never been on the Lark.
And that's to their disadvantage. I'll tell you, those railroads were great. So it's a changed world, and they're all over the place. And I probably would not have been married to an English woman if I hadn't studied over there, I guess. But she spent her career working as a clinical psychologist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute with children and their families. And I come back and say, let me tell you, I had a day. She says, let me tell you about my day. Yeah. And that sort of helps give me perspective. Because problems like that are not just American problems. They're all over the world. And that's true of a lot of things now. Much more, perhaps, than was true. And there we are.
Well, you and Justices Kennedy and Justice John Paul Stevens have cited international conventions, laws, norms in your opinions. On Kennedy, I'm thinking of regarding the homosexual sex, Lawrence v. Texas, and then also in the case about execution of minors. To the latter, Justice Antonin Scalia, the late Justice Antonin Scalia, responded that the basic premise that American law should conform to the laws of the rest of the world ought to be rejected out of hand. So you're making the case to us about the importance and relevance of international law. How do you talk about it with your fellow justices?
It's John Marshall, who was a pretty good judge on our court, who said international law is our law. And the court regularly cited foreign cases where they were relevant until probably around the 1980s and it became an issue. So I don't agree with that, but I note that in a couple of the cases that I would talk about, Justice Scalia and I were on the same side, the antitrust case. He wrote the securities case where we considered views and statutes and briefs from all over the world to decide whether an Australian plaintiff who bought stock in an Australian company and an Australian exchange, but that company, he said, had bought a company in Florida. Is this getting complicated enough? And the company in Florida had lied about what it was worth, and can they sue in New York under our law? A tough question. And we had briefs from all over the world, and he referred to those briefs, and he talked about all of the different laws in the different places and so forth. So when you really get into it, see, when the cases you mentioned, they became issues, in part because Justice Kennedy did refer to the statutes and constitutions and practices of other countries. Well, but consider the subject matters of those cases. The subject matter was death penalty, gay rights, and they're pretty controversial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Joanna, my wife, far be it from me to speculate, but she has told me there is a phenomenon in psychology called displacement. And displacement is you're angry at A, so you blame B. So if I want to speculate, I say some of the people who are pretty angry and don't like that opinion are now blaming foreign law, which had virtually nothing to do with it. Well, I don't see anything wrong with referring to a foreign source. Sometimes it's necessary, as I try to describe, and sometimes it's helpful, and sometimes you read something that seems as if it would be relevant there, and it isn't. We read all kinds of things.
In your own opinion, which you were advised not to do, as we just heard a moment ago, in your 2014 dissent, now this was to uphold the new lethal injection protocol in Oklahoma, you made the point that 137 countries, this is 70% of UN member states, have abolished death penalty either formally or in practice. Now, some people have interpreted that as you telegraphing to lawyers that you're ready to hear death penalty cases. Was that your intent?
Me personally?
You would invite them to the court.
It wasn't that subtle a telegraph. I mean, I ended the thing by saying, I think we should hear death penalty cases. that is no problem about that.
But court watchers
That's very good. But and is this a good example? I do try to keep my opinion short. I try to keep them 10 pages, 15, 20 pages. Well, that one, which was leading up to we ought to reconsider the death penalty, was 46 pages, but who's counting? Now, in those 46 pages, I had quite a number of issues and discussion and argument and so forth. There were probably two or three pages devoted to this and the subject of what the foreign countries do. Now, the word in the Constitution is cruel and unusual punishment. And you can go look at all the conventions you want in 1789 and what they people said. They didn't tell us whether that word unusual meant unusual in the United States or unusual in the world. They didn't tell us. So 3 pages, okay. And if people want to accept that as an additional convincing argument, fine. And if they don't, the other 43 pages do what I thought was a pretty good job, but maybe some others thought it wasn't. But that's one. Justice Scalia and I were good friends. And we miss him. I miss him.
But you guys were willing to mix it up publicly.
Of course. Because, I mean, what I thought we'd do sometimes, which I thought was a great thing to do, I really enjoyed it. We went to Lubbock, Texas, for example. And the two of us sat just like we're sitting. And we had a pretty big audience. We had about 1,000 students there. And we would discuss things we agreed upon and what we didn't. And I felt it was a good discussion. I know what he was worried about with my opinions. He's worried that someone who looks at law as I do will get into the habit of just doing what he thinks subjectively is good. And I say, no, there are all kinds of rules and approaches and so forth that will stop that. And then I worry that he will be too rigid because he likes rules. And I say, you can't go back in the history. You can't get the answer to every question. George Washington didn't know about the internet. And you know what he says when I say that?
What?
He said, I knew that. And so then he says, I'm not saying it solves every problem. This is good. A good story he'd say to me, you see, he'd say it's like the two campers, and one sees the other one putting on his running shoes. He says, why are you putting on running shoes? He says, there's a bear coming into the camp. He says, you can't outrun a bear. And he says, yeah, but I can outrun you. And so we would discuss it, and I think people went away certainly knowing more about the court, and perhaps, I hope, with a somewhat higher opinion. Because they saw we liked each other, we had lots of agreement, and then on some things we didn't agree.
Well, you're talking about one of the big differences was originalism, and publicly you talked about that.
Yes.
And, of course, originalism, you know, this adherence to the original meaning of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, whereas you have said in the past that you look more for values.
Which are the original values. Right. The First Amendment is about speech primarily. You know, that part says freedom of speech.
Right.
But that's a value because it doesn't. We have to apply it to a world that has an internet, of course. And he'll agree with that, but he'll put more weight probably on what the practices were in 1789. Every judge who is trying to decide what some language means in a document will read the language. They will look at the text. They will look at the history. They will look at the traditions. If it's habeas corpus, what's the tradition behind that? What does that mean? They will look at the precedent. They will look at the purposes or the values, and they will look at the consequences. So you have text, history, tradition, precedent, purposes or values, and consequences. Not any consequence, but consequences related to that particular set of words. I mean, the Fourth Amendment's about, say, reasonable searches, it's not about speech, and First Amendment's about speech, so speech-related consequences are likely what's relevant. But the point is, we all use those tools. Everybody does. Some judges put more weight on the first four. You see, text, history, tradition, precedent. Some put more weight on the last two. purposes and consequences. I probably put more weight on the last two, because I think the first four often don't solve the problem. Not always, but often.
How did you arrive at that approach? Why? How did that come into your thinking?
Oh, that's a good question. That's good, because what I think is, I mean, what I've talked about, those six things and put it where you put weight and their questions of degree, we're not, 50% of our cases are unanimous. But why in those, say, 20% where we're 5-4, and let's say half of that where we're on different sides, because they're not all the same 5 and 4. Where are we coming from? It's not politics. I mean, it isn't, I mean, politics, I did work for Senator Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And politics meant, you know, where are the votes? Who's popular? I don't find that in the court. I really do not. Politics, well, you may be ideology. No,
right.
Ideology, no, it's not ideology.
But is it not an ideology? If you're talking about 50% of the cases, you're unanimous, right?
Yeah.
But it's the other cases, and those are often the social issue cases, the
hot-button
social issues. And people can generally predict where the justices are going to come down on that.
Yeah, that's true.
So is that not a sort of ideological bent that
no.
we know the ideological
no.
bent?
Yes and no. Here's the no. The no is, if I think I'm deciding this because I'm an Adam Smith free enterpriser or because I'm a Marxist Maoist troublemaker, I mean, that I know I'm doing the wrong thing. But what is true, insofar as it's a yes, I am the person I am, we all are at a certain age. I did grow up in San Francisco in the 50s. I did go to Lowell High School, public school. I did lead the life I've had. And every one of us, by the time we're in our 50s or so, we have views about our profession at a very abstract level. What's this document about? What is law about? How does it relate to people? What's the country about? I don't have precise answers to those questions, but you will, in whatever profession you are in, will in fact begin to sort of have basic views or jurisprudential approaches or whatever applies to your own profession. That can differ. Nino Scalia was very happy with clear rules, and he tried to push everything into a clear rule. I tend to approach things thinking life is a sort of a mess, and you're not going to get clear anything. And try, but nonetheless, be careful of going too far with a rule, or life will come back and hit you in the face. Now, I'm more comfortable with the latter than he was. And I'm less comfortable, you see, he's more comfortable with the former. Lots of our differences can be explained in that way. I used to think, why doesn't everybody agree with me? How awful. Then I began to think, which is perhaps a slightly more mature view, this is a big country. There are 320 million people. And they think all kinds of different things. And it is not such a terrible thing if on the Supreme Court of the United States there are people who have sort of basic different approaches to some of the questions.
You're listening to a conversation with Justice Stephen Breyer, recorded live at the Historic Theater at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. Here's a question from the audience, and we have a number from law students, so I'll try to get to as many of these as possible. But this person writes, as a young attorney, I'm a bit disheartened by the current legal and political climate of distrust and partisanship and sometimes pure hatred. What can the legal community and the general public do to remain optimistic and hopeful for a brighter and more just future?
Yeah, they can do a lot, in my opinion. And ask anyone in public life, I don't care what branch they're in, I think you won't have to probe too deeply before you'll get a similar response. Look, this document does not tell people what to do. What this document does is, by and large, create outlines or boundaries upon the decisions that the public makes democratically for themselves through elections and through democratic processes. Now, if you look at this as a boundary, I used to listen to that at the when I was a child, Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. He was the border patrol. He was up in the north of Canada. Cold up there and difficult. There are many boundary cases that are difficult. Is abortion inside or outside? What about prayer in schools? But don't make the mistake of thinking, because of boundary definitions being sometimes very difficult, with lots to be said on both sides, don't forget about the space between. And that space between is filled with democratic decision making. And that's what this document expects. Now, what I say to the high school students, is, you have to participate. I can't tell you how to lead your life. I say this a lot. I say to them, I can't tell you. I hope you have a nice life. I hope you find someone to love. I hope you have a good career. And I hope you participate in politics or the library board or the school board or the park or anything you want, as long as it belongs to your community. Because I can't tell you to do it. But I can tell you, in my experience, if you don't do it, this document won't work.
A stirring civics lesson from Justice Stephen Breyer. Our conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage, a partnership between NHPR and the Music Hall. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Stephen Breyer, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. In his 22 years on the Supreme Court, Justice Breyer has largely, though not always, sided with liberal justices. He's been in the dissent on some landmark cases, such as Bush v. Gore, Citizens United, and D.C. v. Heller, a Second Amendment challenge, and has been in the majority for other dramatic decisions, namely the ruling which upheld the Affordable Care Act and the one which struck down bans on same-sex marriage back in 2015. Maybe you noticed that he referred to all nine of us in his opening remarks. Yet the vacancy left by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia in February of 2016 had not been filled when we spoke with Justice Breyer at the Music Hall just about a month before Election Day. Justice Breyer deftly, but with some charm, cast off my attempts to get his opinion on some contemporary issues. That's his job. I kept trying, because that is mine. We did decide to edit out some questions that sounded too of that moment, and others that got this kind of response.
And of course, you would like me to say something about the merits of that law, which I will be very careful not to do.
We did keep some that might sound dated, but that illuminated something larger about the court and his vision of the court. So with that, let's get back to my conversation with Justice Stephen Breyer.
I want to go back to that sort of point about the borderless world that we live in. And you talked earlier about the relative deference of the court to executive powers during the wars. Well, now, of course, we're fighting the war on terror. There is no fixed end date. The enemy is amorphous, borderless, and, you know, attacks in many different places, under many different circumstances. So now, what is the role for the court to protect our civil liberties, those designated to us by the Constitution, and balance that with national security?
There, what I'll say is we should know about what goes on elsewhere. It sometimes will prove relevant, it sometimes won't. I mean, mostly what judges do is not issue grand statements. I mean, sometimes a case leads to that result. I mean, there won't be any more legal segregation in the United States. That was Brown versus Board. That was a pretty grand and important statement. But most of our work is we're sitting there with detailed cases, and we're trying as a matter of detail. And I'm saying a lot of these cases, even including those involving security versus civil liberties, it will be helpful to know the scope of the problem and how other countries deal with it. And what we have to do is find ways of doing that. The lawyers will help us.
But that's a lot of work. That's a lot of understanding. You have to have a depth and breadth of knowledge of how technology works, how other state systems work. And I'm wondering how you and, you know, law students of the future are going to manage that. How do you?
The same way we manage anything else, we don't. We don't know it. I mean, take a copyright case. We had a student from Thailand.
Oh, right.
Yeah, a student
Kurt
from
Thailand.
Yeah, Kurt Seng, right. He's at Cornell. He discovers his textbooks are cheaper in Thailand. He sends his, does his parents send me a few. They sent more than a few. He made a little profit. And the publisher got annoyed and sued him. And it comes up to our court, and the question is whether some very obscure words in a statute say he can do it or he can't do it. Absolutely obscure. But the point I'm trying to make is the way we learn about this. The same way we learn about anything. I go back to my office, there's a stack of briefs like this, filed by lawyers from all over the world, really, on that one. I couldn't figure out why there were so many until I read that it said copyright today is not just a question of books, or not even books, music, film.
It's also, you buy a car, software is copyrighted. Cars filled with software. Go into a store, everything has a label. Labels are typically copyrighted. And what the bottom line is in that brief is that your decision in this case will affect $3.2 trillion worth of commerce. Yeah, that's why there are all those briefs. And even today, $3.2 trillion, a lot of money. So what do we get? The same thing that we have in most cases. It's the job of the lawyers to educate us. And they do, opposite directions, but they do it. When we have they set up in the library an internet thing which we needed to know about for the case, and we're brought in there and we're told about it. And we don't always get those things right. And I'm sorry that we don't, but I mean, imagine a 5-4 case. Somebody's wrong. And, you know, so there are ways of doing this, and that's really most of our job. And that's why I say on these matters, we can in the court indicate that we're willing and interested in what happens abroad. And there's only a limited amount that's relevant. But once that's indicated, I mean, we are a three-part profession. There are the judges and the lawyers and the law professors. And the lawyers have to tell us what's going on that's relevant. And they can do that only if the law professors have in fact told them how to do that when they were law students. And so it's circular. Normally what happens, we'd make a decision, the law professor writes an article saying how wrong it is. At that point, the lawyers read the different articles. See, the professors see the whole picture or a bigger picture. And then the lawyers will read it and they'll transmit to us what favors them, and we'll learn more that way. And then we hope we write a better decision, you see, in this, over this, over here, as this changes. That's what the profession is like, those three parts, when it's working well. And that's what I want it to work well.
I'm thinking of, as you're looking at the world today and what's going on in Congress, in the another branch, and what is not going on in Congress, for example, there are a number of questions here about the fact that the Senate has refused to take up the nomination of Merrick Garland as a Supreme Court justice. So how does that affect your job? You're working in a system of checks and balances.
How has that affected our job? I looked at the numbers, and you can draw your own conclusions. The court had 6 members when it started for a period of years. After the Civil War, it had 10 members, and it functioned. We have 8. And maybe people try a little harder to get together, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Of the 75 cases last year, 4 were 4-4. And 2 of them were the kind of thing you'd read on the front page, and 2 of them you'd never read about in the newspaper. And what you read about in the front page is not necessarily the most important. I mean, I wrote a case involving ERISA, the pension law, and that is so technical as to be beyond belief. But it does affect people's pensions and has a major impact. The press will probably not write about that. It's very technical. But they will write about some, you know, picture on the internet, which maybe doesn't affect so many people, but it's more interesting for the readers. And so you can't draw too much of a conclusion. But you see, since I know it's a big political issue, I'm saying nothing.
Okay, this is a question from a time traveler.
Yes.
If you could travel back to any other court, which one and why?
Oh, you mean in American, mm-hmm. Union, in the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
Yeah, there are so many interesting.
Would it be easier to answer, if you could have been involved in any decision, which one would you have wanted to be involved with?
Well, of course, the great decision is Brown versus Board. I mean, that was very hard to bring about, not in the court. And the reason that it was so hard to get the court to say equal protection of the law means equal protection of the law is because people were afraid. Read Holmes. He was afraid they would say it and nobody would do it. That's what they were afraid of. And then finally, after World War II, they said it. And now think of how long it took before that legal apparatus that supported segregation in much of the country was dismantled. And it isn't perfectly, I mean, we all know it isn't perfect today by any means, but the legal part's dismantled. But think of what people went through for that. After 1954, What happened? Nothing. 55? Nothing. 56? Next to nothing. 57? A judge in Little Rock says integrate Central High School. Now, some of us can remember that. Little Rock 9. Brave? Black? Trying to enter a white school with a court order. Governor Faubus is standing in the doorway, in effect, and says, maybe they have a court order, but I have the state militia. White Citizens Council surrounding the school. The picture of Elizabeth Eckford, a black girl walking off and reading her book, and white girl behind her, her face contorted with rage. You see? The world saw that. And President Eisenhower met with Governor Faubus. And Faubus said, I'll integrate Central High. And then he walked out and told the press he wouldn't. And Eisenhower was pretty annoyed. Jimmy Burns, governor, moderate on race, governor of South Carolina, says to President Eisenhower, if you send troops, you will have to occupy the entire South. Do you want a second Reconstruction? But Herbert Brownell, his wise counselor, attorney general, said, you have to do something. And Eisenhower ordered the 101st Airborne. Oh, in 1957, everyone knew who they were. They were the heroes of D-Day. To Little Rock, and take those children and walk them into the school. Now, that was a great day for the rule of law. And it was a great day for the country. Fabulous. But within a few months, they'd close the school. Mm-hmm. Just what Jimmy Burns said. And this time, the Supreme Court said, well, unanimously said, no, you've got to integrate. And the day after that opinion came down, Cooper versus Aaron, the governor closed the school. And read about what happened to those children, black and white. Not great. You see, it was too late. It was Martin Luther King, the Freedom Riders. The whole country had gotten involved. And that was a time when I was clerking, 1964, later, to little, but it was still going on. You see, and my point there is that the whole country, or not the whole country, but a lot of people who were not lawyers and not judges had to get involved. And that's what I say. I said that to the president of the court of Ghana, a woman who's trying to bring more human right protection and democracy there. She says, why do people do what you say? Ha ha, good question. I say it's 200 years of history. It's not just some words written on paper. And what you have to do, and we had a civil war, we had 80 years of Jim Crow, I mean, we've had all kinds of stuff and things, and not always good. We've had our ups and downs. Now, people pretty much do it. But they have to learn, the next generations.
We're going to run out of time, so I just want to ask you a couple of questions, a little bit about what you do, what goes on at the court, and we'll have to wrap. In those difficult cases, have you absolutely been agonized over a case ever?
Sure. But you know, you don't go around saying, oh, it's the job. I mean, you have what we do, the way we receive briefs, as I said. There'll be a blue brief for the petitioner's side and a red brief for the other side. I don't know why they call them briefs. They're not that brief. But the yellow one, the reply, and then anyone can file a light green for the petitioner, any group, and dark green for the respondent, and gray if you're the government. The government's always gray. And I get a stack, maybe 12, 15, 20 briefs, and sometimes 100, as in, for example, the affirmative action cases, but normally. So I take the 12 cases that they're going to be oral argument in two-week bits. There will be probably 10 to 12 cases, and I read those briefs. And I divide them among my law clerks and say, you read three, and you better know it four times better than me. And then I'll talk to them beforehand, and they'll write a memo on things I want to know, and they can put in anything else they want. So before that oral argument, I've read the briefs. I've had one or two discussions with my law clerks, and they've written a memo on points I wanted explored. Everyone does something like that. So when we're out there with the oral argument, we think we know the case. Now, do we have a preconceived idea? Of course. When I see the question, I have a preconceived idea. This is the question in the case. I know who's right. Then I read the blue brief. Of course, they're right. Then I read the red brief. Oh. And that's how it works. You get there in the oral argument, I know who's right. Oh. Being open-minded, I think, in every profession, really, is not that you go in without an idea. You know where you're going, but you're ready to change. Once you take in information that changes that mind, you don't resist it. Rather, you listen. And gradually what's happening, by the end of the oral argument, people say, does it change your mind? I'd say completely, maybe 5% of the time. Does it change how I look at the case? Much more often. Does it matter how you look at it? Absolutely. Why? Because that opinion, it's not just the result, it's the words that are in it. So after the oral argument, we'll be within a couple of days, we'll be in our conference room, we're there by ourselves, we're around a big table, we each have a book for each case, which has the name of each justice and space to write. The Chief Justice says, this is the issue in the case, this is what I'm thinking, maybe 5 or 10 minutes. And then it would go to Justice Scalia, Justice Kennedy, Justice Thomas, Justice Ginsburg, me, Justice Alito, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan. Nobody speaks twice till everybody speaks once. A very good rule for a small group. Everybody thinks he's been treated fairly. And then there's some back and forth. But if the back and forth is, I have a better argument than you, ha, 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 that will get you nowhere. Someone on the other side who has a different approach will say, I have a better argument than you. But if you're listening to what the other person says, and you think you have something to contribute to that thought, then things might be different. And everyone knows that. And sometimes we'll have a very fruitful discussion, and it might change people's minds, and sometimes it won't be so fruitful. But at the end of that, you know where it's breaking out. And the Chief Justice, if he's in the majority, whoever's senior, will assign the case. Everyone writes one, then everyone writes two, then everyone writes three. It's fairly mechanical. But if it's given to me, I already said what I do. My law clerk produces something like this. I take that. I go get the briefs, those I think are good briefs, and I sit down at the word processor, and I write my draft back to the law clerk. She thinks hers was better. Nonetheless, there we are. And she goes over it. I'll probably do another draft from scratch very often. And then she goes back, and we'll go back and forth, and eventually we circulate. And when we circulate, I want four others to join it at least. I'm hoping for everybody, but I'll settle for five. And someone might write a dissent, and things can switch. Sometimes the whole court flips. But more often, it stays roughly the same, but people have suggestions, changes. They want this or that and modified. Eventually, everybody's written or said whatever he wants or joined, and it comes out. That's the mechanics. So I told my son, what I do, I read and I write. I said, you do your homework really well. You get a job, you can do homework the whole rest of your life.
Stephen Breyer, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States and author most recently of The Court and the World. Our conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage, a co-production of New Hampshire Public Radio and the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. NHPR's president is Betsy Gardella. The Music Hall producer and communication director is Margaret Talcott. Broadcast producer is Molly Donahue. NHPR digital producer, Sarah Plourd. The Music Hall production manager is Jana Morris. Live sound and recording and mixing engineer is Ian Martin. Musical director and band, Bob Lord and Dreadnought. Photos from the event are posted at Clear Eye Photo. And here's a little bonus for you. Before the show, Justice Breyer sat down with me in the green room to record a 10-minute writer's workshop. We focused on opinions, some historical, some that he admired of others. These words that become the law of the land for generations. All of which he answered with the kind of knowledgeable enthusiasm that you heard here. You can listen to that one or subscribe to all of the 10-Minute Writers Workshop podcasts on iTunes and on Google Play. Or you can just go listen on our website. You can see photos from all of our events and listen to more author interviews from the series. Just go to wordofmouthradio.org and click on the 10-Minute Writers Workshop link or the Writers on a New England Stage link, or better yet, both. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this has been a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from NHPR.